You're listening to the Electric City Magazine podcast. Earlier this year, a Peterborough interfaith community invited the chair of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, Bernie Farber, to speak at their gathering, Many Windows, One Light. The next morning, Bernie took some time to talk with Peter Pula of Electric City Magazine about historical and intergenerational pain, the courage it takes to stand up to acts of racism, and to give kudos to those he sees exercising their agency to make a difference, including members of our community.
Well, Bernie Farber, thank you very much for joining
us. Well, thank you for inviting me.
All right, very much appreciate your taking time out today. Just for kicks, let's start with a little bit of context.
Sure.
Why did you come to Peterborough? Why did you say yes?
Well, I said yes because I was invited to participate in this wonderful diversity program that you have here. And Peterborough is an hour and a half from Toronto, and whenever I have an opportunity to travel to communities and spread our message, now the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, but even the work that I do on developing social consciousness and trying to create modes of dialogue, I try to get out there. So the only issue that stood in our way was Canadian weather systems. And Mark Siegel, who's part of the committee to put it together, he and I were in touch from the late fall to literally the last day, and then Ralph came in as well, and we were looking at all kinds of ways of ensuring that, you know, if there's a snowstorm, which did happen, of course, but it happened 2 days before, that I'd be able to get here. But no problem. It was a beautiful day. It's a beautiful weekend in Peterborough. Got to see the Canadian Canoe Museum, which I'd never seen before, and so it's really been lovely.
Right, and who called you here?
I came through Mark Siegel, who got in touch with me originally through the Beth Israel Synagogue. And it was an amalgamation of a number of groups for Many Windows, One Light. And what an interesting name. Great logo. That really speaks to the fact that we are a community of communities here in Canada. And in many ways, Peterborough is kind of like the microcosm of that. What happens elsewhere in even larger centers happens intensely here in Peterborough. So it was a wonderful committee. I met lots of very, very decent and good people who want to make the world a better place. You know, in my tradition, in the Jewish tradition, we have this concept known as Tikkun Olam, which is kind of a commandment, which tells us as a people that you're not born for nothing, that in fact you were put on this earth in the long run to do something good, to leave the world a little bit better than how you found it. And so the work that's being done here in Peterborough is part of that Tikkun Olam project. So that's why I was so happy and actually quite honored to be involved with it.
What struck you about the sense that you have of the people that you met?
Well, there was a goodness, there was a sense of calm, but mostly there was this dialogue, which interestingly you don't see in large centers. You know, one of the issues that I've been working with for more years than I care to think about now, especially when I began with Canadian Jewish Congress and then on through my work with the Mosaic Institute and now with the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, and prior to that with the Paloma Foundation, was this development of dialogue, is getting communities together to talk. And what I found here is that in many ways, you know, Peterborough is kind of ahead of the curve. Communities do come together here and do talk. And I don't know, but what I think it is that when you have a smaller space that you share, you run into people all the time. And it's not like you can, like in Toronto, where you can really get lost in the populace. Here you have communities of communities, and you do know each other, and you do have to find ways to get along. And I think, I'm not sure if you've actually found the secret, but I think part of the secret is just understanding that you can't avoid certain things. And in big cities and in big urban centers, there's a lot of avoidance in terms of getting into meaningful dialogue that can help change things. So that's what I found here, and it's been both enlightening and refreshing.
Beautiful. Thank you. You had something I very much appreciated about your words yesterday. You had some appreciative things to say about things that you'd seen happen in Peterborough. Can you just share a little bit about those things again for us now?
So we live in a time of, how shall I put this? It's dangerous times right now. There's been a growth of hate movements in Canada. There has been an increase in verbosity and an increase in rhetoric. And what we need to try and do is bring the temperature down. I think a lot of people are afraid to bring the temperature down because it means you have to kind of act with a little boldness and you have to be courageous and do those types of things. And people, I think, want to feel that they are, but they very rarely act like they are. But Peterborough was a little bit different. So there was a situation that developed over the last decade or so. The two most targeted communities, faith communities, targeted meaning with hatred and hate crimes and that type of thing, have been the Canadian Muslim community and the Canadian Jewish communities. It's been horrible. And it's something that police are trying to get their hands handle on and others. And you had an incident here in Peterborough, a terrible incident, in which the local mosque was set on fire purposely. It was an arson. Small Muslim community here. And I can understand how they feel. Because I was brought up in a small Jewish community in Ottawa. I was the only Jewish child that went to my public school, one of two, I think. They never went by that I wasn't faced with anti-Semitism. That's just kind of the way it was. So I'm certainly able to put myself in the shoes of, Muslim community here. And when the fire was set and the building was burnt down, one of the first groups to reach out to the Muslim community was the Beth Israel Synagogue. And you think about that, that's neat. it's touching. And it is because, again, in large urban centers, there's no dialogue going on, for example, between Jews and Muslims. It just doesn't happen. And those that have tried to do outreach have just been singularly unsuccessful. I mean, imams and rabbis will get together, but the so-called secular leadership of the communities don't. Yet here in Peterborough, when something terrible like this happened, the first group to reach out was the Jewish community. Why? Well, I think as Jews, they understood this pain. They got it right away. And so they had this kind of wonderful thing, right, where the mosque members are able to use space in the Beth Israel Synagogue, which shares part of their space with the Unitarian Church. I mean, these are all the threads that are brought together here in a place like Peterborough. So that was number one that I noted as, again, part of that interesting microcosm. And then the second thing, which hit even closer to home to a certain extent because of my work now with the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, which we'll talk a little bit about later, there has been a growth of hate groups here in this country. White supremacist, neo-Nazi, racist, anti-immigration. And it's probably been the largest growth of its kind that we've seen since the post-World War II era. We had a similar rise in hate group activity in the late 80s and 1990s in Canada. It declined over the early part of the 21st century, and now it is on a rise as steep as I've ever seen it. And it's dangerous, and we've seen the horrible effects of that in the last almost 2 years. 18 Canadians have been murdered as a result of hard right-wing extremism. That's never happened before in this country. So it's not just something where somebody draws a swastika on a synagogue wall. It's there. And one of the things that we have to do as a community is that when these groups rise and they raise their heads, there has to be an equal and opposite reaction. Sometimes it happens. Rarely, usually it doesn't. But it happened here. And there was a group that calls itself the Canadian Nationalist Party. You can tell by its name. You know what? They choose interesting names. I'll go into that a little later. But they choose names that sound benign. Canadian Nationalist Party. You know, what could be wrong with nationalism? The last neo-Nazi party in Canada in the 1990s, 80s, was called the Heritage Front. Heritage, great, wonderful. What could be wrong with heritage, right? Until you scratch just a little bit deeper, and you usually don't have to scratch that much, and you'll find what they're really all about. You know, anti-racist, racist, and many are anti-immigrant, and et cetera, et cetera. So this group called the Canadian Nationalist Party had threatened to have an anti-Muslim, anti-immigration demonstration, march here on Confederation Square here in Peterborough. And the word got out, and hundreds showed up. Remember, this is a community of, 80,000 people. Close to 1,000 people came to Confederation Square to stand shoulder to shoulder with the victims against the victimizers. And that's the way it should. If I had to draw a map of how to do this, of how my father used to say, you want to get something done, you got to open a mouth, how to open a mouth, I would have just taken a video of what happened in Peterborough and just shown it to everybody. That was remarkable. It was really remarkable. And actually, you should excuse the expression, but the event kind of petered out as a direct result of this show of unanimity. It was really a spectacular thing. And it was a kind of thing that I think gives expression of this positiveness to the entire country. And it's an example to behold. So those are the two major issues that I discussed in my address yesterday. And they weren't hard to find, you know. I mean, I did my research. I'd also heard about them beforehand, and I just did a little bit more exploration. I thought, wow, you know, this is, it's not like I have a lot to teach people of Peterborough, but I do have a lot to point out that, in fact, sometimes you do have to say, again, in my community, in my tradition, we have a term, we say, kol hakavod. That means all strength to you. And sometimes when people do the right thing, you got to tell them that they're doing the right thing.
Beautiful. Thank you. So something else I appreciate about your remarks yesterday is that the work of legislation, the context that our laws create for the way we interact in society, the work of organizations like yours, provides a sense of structure and clarity around ethics and some air cover for this kind of conversation that we need to have. In the meantime, what you also shared were some very clear examples of what ordinary people who have lives in other realms can do when confronted with racism. Because I think we can feel sometimes that we don't have agency, but the stories you just told about Peterborough very clearly demonstrate where you've seen agency acted out here. And you had a few other stories. Mm-hmm. So I want to explore that a little bit more. What can people, ordinary people, do in everyday life to... I just said, when we see an act of racism, speak up, be brave, stand up. And you shared that you've seen that in Peterborough.
Yeah.
What other kinds of things that can individuals do?
You know, it's interesting. This is a question that I'm asked almost all the time. What can an individual do when they see something happening in front of them? Well, first, I want to acknowledge that it's really difficult. I mean, it's difficult. You know, people are justifiably concerned and justifiably afraid for their own safety often, and do not want to put themselves out, and we ought not to judge. But I think that as human beings, we have kind of a responsibility one unto the other. And of course, I do not advocate violence, but I do advocate what I would call active interference. And what do I mean by that? And I told the story yesterday of a story that I was told what happened in Toronto when a young woman, a Muslim woman, was on the subway, and she was wearing her hijab and she was sitting peacefully minding her own business, and somebody came up and started actually yelling and screaming at her, calling her horrible names and go back to where you came from and we don't need you here. And people were getting visibly uncomfortable, on the subway train, until one middle-aged woman came, and what she did was she sat in front of the young Muslim woman and put her arm around her, just started talking to her. "Now, tell me about where you come from, and tell me about your children, and, you know, what's going on?" And she put her back between the Muslim woman and the man who was engaging in this kind of terrible activity. And it got him so frustrated because he was completely blocked off. It wasn't only that she was not paying attention to him, it was that this wall just blocked him off. And he just got fed up and walked away. That was really an act of what I call active interference without putting the other person in any danger. And it's the kind of thing that all of us can do. The other thing I tell people to do, and again, it's difficult, not because necessarily at this point you're afraid of you know, physical altercation, but certainly all of us have heard, even friends and casual acquaintances, use words and phrases that are bigoted and racist. And I think you have to confront it. So, you know, if you hear somebody using a term that you feel is inappropriate or you find offensive, even if you're not a person of color and you hear, you know, something that's off-putting, I think you have to say to the person, really, you know, what you've said, it's offensive, and really you should think twice about using that kind of a phrase. And you don't have to do it really even in a judgmental way. You can just say, this hurts me when I hear this. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult. It's not easy. But we have to do it, because if we don't do it, we kind of give them permission to continue. So these are the kinds of things that I think ordinary people can do all the time.
When you're talking about the power of words and how words are important, how labels are important, and what I'm hearing from you now is that very much this notion that words create worlds.
Absolutely.
And what kind of world are we creating with the words that we use?
Absolutely. As
and
a matter
to be
of
conscious
fact,
of that.
And I've said often that the Holocaust, which, you know, for me as an individual, as a Jew growing up in Canada, I'm the child of Holocaust survivors. So I was brought up in the shadow, and I know that it was, you know, gas chambers didn't just happen. They started with words. That's where everything starts. And if you start resisting at the hateful word stage, you might have been able to cut things off. But if you don't, it festers and it grows and it becomes horrible, as we have seen, and not just with the Holocaust. I mean, we've seen it with the, you know, with the Rwandan genocide, and we've seen it in Cambodia, and we've seen it even today. So it's important. Beyond anything that we can imagine, to respond, to react, to open a mouth and to say something in a way that doesn't put you in any jeopardy, but at the same time gives a very clear message that these kinds of phrases and these kinds of words and this type of racism is just not acceptable. End of story.
There is a relatively credible idea that one of the factors in how World War II came to be about is that the old ways were changing so fast that people were losing their guilds, losing community, losing their faith community, so on and so forth, so that the sense of community was very much missing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the things that we've talked about or that you've talked about are what can happen in the higher levels in the strata of law and institutional
right.
advocacy. We've also talked about the bravery and courage that a person on a subway mm-hmm. exhibits, and a little bit about what you've seen in Peterborough in terms of the action of groups coming together. But you also spoke about civil dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And if, for example, community is what gives us the strength to stand up and be brave, I would suspect that civil dialogue and forms for that would make sense. So you've talked about a few stories
yeah.
there too. What have you seen where communities have created community through civil dialogue, where people come to understand each other's pain
yeah.
and each other's stories so that they're human?
There is, I do believe, actually safety in numbers. And I do believe that many of us have shared common experiences, but we've never shared them, if I could put it that way. So there was a time when I was the head of the Canadian Jewish Congress that one of the one of the things that I had on my to-do list was to better understand First Nations communities. In a kind of a very strange way, Jews and Aboriginal people traveled similar roads of pain. We had, meaning the Jewish community, had a different experience in that we still, even with all our tragedy and all our pain, we were still part of quote-unquote white society. You know, we had white privilege, for lack of a better term. Not that it did us any good during World War II, but, you know, it did help us in the later years develop and et cetera, et cetera, whereas First Nations kind of remain on this track where to this very day they remain discriminated against and we have lots of work to do. So one of the things that I was able to do was I was able to bring two groups together, leadership of the Canadian Jewish community and leadership of the First Nations community. And together we planned a trip to Israel. This was not a political trip. This was actually a trip to kind of demonstrate how, in a way, two Aboriginal peoples, the Jews being one of the original peoples of that land, and the original people of the land of Canada, had shared common experiences that could be helpful in terms of learning on both sides. Never mind the fact that we both faced genocide. Now, I know this might be a little surprising to some of your, you know, people who are watching this, but in fact, First Nations here in this country faced a genocide committed by colonialists, by Canadians. Yes, we did. If you take a look at the definition of genocide as developed by the United Nations, the residential school system was a form of genocide. It's unquestioned. And when I wrote about this back in 2010, 2011, I wrote a piece with Chief Phil Fontaine and Dr. Michael Dan, who's a good friend and an Aboriginal advocate as well. And we wrote a piece called The Canadian Genocide in Search of a Name. And it was one of the first times that two non-Aboriginal people came together with an Aboriginal leader and wrote of this genocide. Now listen, I write about a lot of things. And a lot of people react to what I write. Sometimes they like it, sometimes they don't, and I hear from both sides.
Well, I think Ben gave you the label of provocateur.
Provocateur, correct. Yeah, which I thought that's good. I like that, yeah. So this was one of the pieces that provoked all kinds of very harsh reaction. Canadians, they were not involved in a genocide, but it opened eyes. Anyway, I tell the story because, you know, 18 of us went to Israel together. And as an aside, we planned all kinds of sort of interesting trips to kibbutzim, which are large collective farms in Israel, because we wanted to plant some proverbial seeds along how this can be maybe, you know, transplanted here to Canada, type of thing. But interestingly, lots of First Nations chiefs said to me, well, you know, we would like to see where Jesus did his ministry. And we want to see where John the Baptist did his ministry. We'd like to go to Capernaum, which actually quite shocked me. And I remember saying to Phil Fontaine, you went through the residential school system. They forced Christianity onto you. You really rebelled against that. Why would you want to see all this? And he said, because they did a very good job. You know, we're still Christian despite what happened here. So we had to actually, you know, change our entire schedule, and it was fascinating for me because I learned. At the end of our trip, we went to a place in Jerusalem, a museum. It's called Yad Vashem. And Yad Vashem is the museum of the Holocaust. And I've been there many times. And attached to the museum is what's known as the Children's Memorial. It was built and designed by Moshe Safdi, amazing designer. And it's a place of deep contemplation and it's a very difficult place to be in. What happens is you walk down into this cavern-like structure that is very dark, and it's lit by the flame of one large candle in the middle that is reflected tens of thousands of times. And so all you see around you is a flickering of this candle through mirrors. It's really remarkable. And as you're walking through the names of the 1.5 million children under the age of 10 who were murdered during the Holocaust, either in death camps or in killing pits or what have you, are repeated. And it says it takes about 18 months, almost two years, to go through the entire list of names. And so you can imagine how powerful that is. And as you walk out actually into the Jerusalem valley, overlooking the Judean hills, and it's, you know, you walk from the past into the present and the future. But it's just heartbreaking. And any time I go there, I walk out and I'm in tears. I had two half-brothers. My father had been married and had children before the war. And he's the sole survivor of his small Polish village of 450 Jews. He's the only one that survived. So this was it particularly hits me. And Fred Kelly, who is an elder out near Winnipeg, reserve in Winnipeg, came up to me and he said, I feel your pain. I understand your pain. And we're going to have a healing circle. A healing circle? I'm never one for one healing circle. Okay, well, we'll have a healing circle. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? Nothing. So there were 18 of us outside the Children's Memorial. And a healing circle consisted of us all joining arms. And we had a talking stick. Which is if you ever want to do community dialogue, and I do it all the time now, I use a talking stick. That's why not 1,000 people talk at the same time. And you have to have the talking stick, you know, in order to speak. And we passed a talking stick along, and each and every one of us had a story to tell about pain, about losing a child, about things taken from us, about discrimination. All of the chiefs had been children in residential schools, or their parents had been children in residential schools. And they talked about the pain of losing childhood, the pain of losing, literally losing a brother and a sister. Thousands of First Nations children died or were murdered in some of these residential schools, are in unmarked graves. I mean, the pain is unbelievable. And, and Fred said to us in his healing circle, while your numbers were far greater, the life of one still impacts us all. And it was like the pain that I was feeling kind of dissipated, you know? I mean, we all shared each other's pain. And not a lot of words were shared. I mean, we just told our stories. That's all we did. And by telling our stories and by absorbing those stories into our hearts and into our souls, we became different people. And so, you know, when people talk about dialogue isn't always necessarily with tons of words. Dialogue can just be feeling each other's pain and, by the way, feeling each other's joy. And so I learned a very valuable lesson on that day that I'd never learned before, that dialogue has all kinds of little different roads that you can go down. And I guess most importantly is the power to engage. And we're not there yet, you know. I mean, there have been some very active dialogues. I mean, there are a number of us in the Jewish community who are now very actively involved with First Nations issues. Dr. Michael Dant, whom I worked with at the Paloma Foundation, he actively was working on the concept of building viable economies on reserves. So finding not just work, but for example, here in Curve Lake, he's working on the concept of developing an electricity project, because on their own territory they have free falling water, and once you set up an electrical station, and you can provide electricity through the grid. It's kind of like an ATM machine. As long as the water's running, you know, electricity is being produced, and small reserves can become economic bases. It's amazing. Sadly, neither the provincial or federal governments are there yet, and we need them as partners. And the concept has worked on a couple of reserves, and it's changed their lives. So that's one thing. When it looked like this really wasn't going to go much further, Michael took what was left in the Paloma Foundation, millions of dollars, to be honest, and donated it to the Dalai Lama School of Public Health at the University of Toronto to create the very first Aboriginal Health Research Center. It's now 2 years old, and it's the only one of its kind anywhere in North America. And the reason he did this is not just because he's a wonderfully progressive philanthropist, which he is, but you may recall 4 or 5 years ago, during the Harper years, that government removed funding for Aboriginal health research. And his view was he never again wanted Aboriginal communities to be dependent on government for health research. So he seeded this program. So part of the story, which I told at dinner last night,
That is a bit of an interesting indictment, that a community might be prepared to move forward on something requires partnership from government of some level, and simply can't get that partnership.
We can speak about that for hours, honestly. Right. It makes me so angry.
A short statement is enough, probably.
You basically just said it, okay? I mean, you know, how is it possible that for 20 years, dozens of reserves in Canada have been on boil water advisories? 20 years. I mean, we're doing some work now with some Israeli investors who have developed this machine that cleans water. It's a portable machine. You put it in the trunk of your car, and it will clean gallons and gallons and gallons of water. And these investors are prepared to donate these machines to various reserves. But they're blockages by government.
I've heard of more than one story where the government's involved, not prepared to move.
Exactly.
Is actually what stops the project. And in fact, the community could move, but they only need the government to simply say
yes.
Just to not say no.
No, right.
Right, well, or to actually step in and say, well, we're not going to allow you to do that.
So, Peter, imagine this, okay? Let's say Peterborough, all of a sudden, for a day, your water system broke down. And there's a boil water advisory, and they say, you know what, we're not going to be able to fix this for a year. How long do you think that would last? Maybe 25 minutes before the good people of Peterborough rose up?
I like to think that the good people of Peterborough would come together in conversation and look around and say, hey, well, I've got this, and I've got that, and I know how to do this, and Joe and Mary know how to do these things, so let's get together and sort this out.
You would hope so. And here, probably it would happen. But it doesn't happen everywhere. Anyhow, get off track.
I kind of want to blow water main just to see what happens.
And back to Joaquin Benesse Price. Right. This is such a fascinating story because it talks about the power of one person in one community who had the means to do something. But again, by our tradition, you know, you're supposed to give to charity, but you're not supposed to revel in it, right? So I mean, people like to be recognized. I get that, you know. If I gave, you know, $20 million or something, I'd like to know people to know that.
Well, I think we all do.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Sure, and if you're a philanthropist, right, and you have a talent for building capital wealth,
exactly,
and therefore it's a gift that you can then also give. But in the community and civil dialogue world, we all have a gift.
We all have a gift.
And just as the philanthropist may or may not wish to be seen in it, most of us also want to be seen in our gifts. Our gifts aren't gifts until they're seen and received.
Exactly.
And everybody has a gift.
So how do you live by this maxim, right? Or this maxim? So Michael, the university approached Michael and said, we'd like to name this research center the Dr. Michael Dann Research Center for Aboriginal Health. And he said, no, I don't want it named after me. And he kept on insisting, he kept on pushing. He said, I'm going to speak to my elder. So he went to his elder, an Aboriginal man, and he said, the elder is very wise, he said, you know, there's nothing wrong with using your name, but if you want to be true to what you're doing, you have an Aboriginal name. Use your Aboriginal name. He said, great idea. So he used his Aboriginal name, which is Joaquin Benesse. And Joaquin Benesse means radiant thunderbird. So not only that.
That's pretty stoked.
It's pretty stoked. Gets better. Gets better. He also wanted to recognize a man by the name of Dr. Peter Bryce. I would venture to guess that if you went out here down the street and asked people, who's Dr. Peter Bryce, nobody would know who he was. He was Canada's first medical officer of health. He was charged in the early 1900s to go to the first established residential schools to determine why so many children were dying of tuberculosis and smallpox. And he went and he saw kids are being brought, forcibly brought from reserves with TB or with smallpox, being placed into these open populations of other children who were...
Congregated settings.
There was no windows that were open. I mean, simple little things that the government could have done. He made his report, said, we can save the lives of thousands of children if you just did A, B, and C. They took the report and they ripped it up, and he was aghast. And he went public. He was one of the first Canadian whistleblowers, and he wrote a paper in 1911, I think, called Canada's National Shame. And he self-published it. And of course,
another active agency, exactly.
And the government was actually forced to take some action at that time. One of the actions they took was they fired him. He died more or less a pauper. He has a
privilege can be erased very quickly.
It certainly can be. His grave is in Ottawa, and it's he's now become lately popularized. And Michael said, "No, we have to honor this man's memory as well." So it became the Waukebaness Bryce Center for Aboriginal Health Research, and it's part of the University of Toronto. It's online if people want to check it out. And let's go back to your original question of individuals coming together, communities coming together. The Dan family is a very well-known Jewish family in Toronto that came together with the Aboriginal community to do this wonderful thing together, not necessarily even through dialogue, but through action. And it's a marvelous thing. But it doesn't happen often enough.
And those aren't necessarily institutions moving.
No.
Those are people moving together.
They're absolutely
people. And possibly
people
even creating institutions.
Yeah.
But it didn't begin there. It began with the people choosing to do something together.
Exactly. And again, it's a story that I urge people who are watching, listening to this, go online and check out the Waukebaness Bryce Center. That's Waukebaness, Waukebaness Bryce Center. Go onto their website. Story's right there. It's really a beautiful story. So that's one thing. Where we have fallen down, at least in my experience, when I worked with the Mosaic Institute, and probably nobody's heard of the Mosaic Institute, and that's too bad. Some may have. Our goal, we're a charity, an educational charity, and our goal was to work with communities that have been historically, most of these are recent immigrant communities to Canada that have been historically basically at each other's throats. This could be Turks and Cypriots, Jews and Muslims, you name them, they're all out there. And we created safe spaces for them to come together and to engage in what I call civil but passionate dialogue. More often than not, this happened on the university campus. We did, and we had great success on university campuses. We still do to this very day. We didn't have such great success with adults, because adults, it seemed, were still more set in their ways. Their historical memories were much greater, and it was much more difficult to permeate. But we were able to, for example, bring together Jews and Ukrainians. Now, that's kind of interesting, given that the World War II experience was not a happy one. But young people are basically saying, we're Canadian. It's time to kind of not put aside our history and not forget our history, but use our history to invigorate us to change. And so, we did quite well. Where we didn't do so well was the trying to develop dialogue between Jews and Muslims. Again, we come back to what Peterborough has done and has done it so well. But in places like Toronto and Vancouver and other places where there have been small pockets of dialogue, imams and rabbis have gotten together, individuals, smaller groups have gotten together, but the actual so-called established leadership of the communities have never officially come together in this country yet. And of course, the big elephant in the room is the Middle East, is Israel, and what that means to these two different groups. And look, my view is, and I like to consider myself pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian. I still believe in that kind of dream that these two people can find a way to live together. I have to. Sometimes it seems to move further away, but I still have to hope for that. But I'll tell you, I have many Muslim friends and many Palestinian friends, and we agree on much, but we also disagree on much. And we're allowed to. You're allowed to agree to disagree with people, and you can disagree passionately. You can hold your, you can hold what's true and valuable to you, and still be friends.
Well, I think one of the phenomena is when leaders of organizations or movements or churches or religions or governments come together, they often carry with them not just their own sensibilities as a person. They also carry with them their position, the mandate, the megahorn that comes from being at the top of one of those hierarchies.
Or at least what they think.
That's right. That's right. So they carry this notion that they're to speak on behalf of entire pyramid, if you like.
Yeah.
And that actually causes great distance, because as those pyramids get wider at the bottom, there's more distance between the peaks.
Yeah.
Whereas the stories you've told about citizens coming together, community members coming together, those things aren't necessarily there. We're hearing our direct and personal stories, which is more real, more embodied, and therefore more likely to produce agency and possibly even surprising possibilities.
So let's talk about surprising possibilities, because one of the surprising possibilities occurred last year when a very courageous Orthodox rabbi in Toronto was asked to attend an Orthodox or a traditional mosque in Mississauga, Ontario. Here we are in 2019, and this has never happened before in Canada. An Orthodox rabbi has never attended a Juma service in a mosque in the Greater Toronto area. And to his very great credit, he chose to attend. And I went with him. I had the honor of attending with him. I'd been to a Juma service before. He never had. And it's quite a remarkable thing. If nobody's been to a Juma service just to observe, I urge you to go. Unlike Christian church services or synagogue services, the Juma service on a Friday begins at 1 o'clock. And it's a great hall in this particular mosque. And we got there around 1:45. And it was empty. You can hear a mouse scatter across the floor of it, if such a thing were to happen. Totally empty. And within 10 minutes, because the service was beginning at 1 o'clock, almost 800 people crowded into the room. And we were obvious by our distinctiveness. The rabbi wore a skull cap. I was with him. The people were gracious. They were kind. They all came up to us and thanked us for being there. The service lasted exactly 30 minutes. And that was it. And then they were gone. That was it. I mean, all of us can, sometimes Sunday services in church can last a little long. Certainly synagogue services can last way too long. So this is something we can learn from. But what we really learned was that an Orthodox rabbi and a traditional imam can come together at a service like this and be together. So little by little, steps are being taken. I can tell you, sadly, that the trolls on social media, of course, went bananas and cursed me and cursed the rabbi. These are the types of things that happen. And social media can be a bit of a devil when it comes to these things. It's kind of like the kazaba. You can get anything you want on social media, the good and the bad and the ugly, right?
Just to do a little bit of architecture work so that we can offer something to people who want to create these civil dialogues. In your story about traveling with the chiefs, mm-hmm. place was important because you went to a place.
Correct.
And the place had a story. And the place moved you. There was also a cultural exchange in that experience. I also heard you say that you were surprised by a few things. So maybe one of the elements to success in this deeper kind of dialogue is to be open to and expect the unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if we go in with sort of what you're saying with having success with university communities, but not so much in the general community, that the older participants in conversations seem more locked in or less permeable mm-hmm. in their boundaries. So being open to and expecting the unexpected and open to learning seems to be another element that I heard in your story. You also told the story about a healing circle,
yeah,
which is a form of dialogue.
It is.
It's
absolutely
held in a sacred space. It's also not held in the sense that you and I might compete for attention in this conversation. The talking stick, talking piece, removes that, because we will wait until the speaker is finished before we take up the piece and it's passed along.
Yeah.
And for the most part, in forms like that, people don't necessarily, there's not crosstalk. And we just hear, bring it in, receive it, and then we hear from another. And this creates a different kind of dialogue. So there's a form.
Mm-hmm.
And that healing circle was a circle. There's a form and an intention around mm-hmm. healing. So that's another element I heard in your story. Yeah, I think those were the... And you also said there's a variety of dialogue forms that you've mm-hmm. experienced. And another element was to be prepared to face the pain.
And to be with it. Yeah, that
together.
To me is one of the most important factors, because we turn our back on pain. You know, we do everything we can to limit pain. I get that. I think we all understand that. But at the same time, when we're trying to struggle with understanding each other and accepting each other, if we're not open to hearing each other's pain, we're not open. We have to hear both the good and the bad, right? I mean, that's part of growing up.
And this might be a crazy or radical question, and if it just doesn't work, we'll just pitch it. But one of the thoughts I have is that if we learn to hate, if people learn to hate, is there some pain that is at the root of that?
Mm-hmm.
And is there a way, number one, I think being in community differently and in the kinds of ways you've explored would probably strengthen me and encourage me, provide me courage if I see or hear words or see an action that needs to be stood against. If I feel that I'm in community,
wow,
I'm more likely to stand up.
It's kind of interesting you say this. Because in my years of working on these issues, I did have an experience where I was able to help a young woman who was a member of a white supremacist organization actually get out of that organization. And her story, her name is Elizabeth Moore, and she's well known because she's now one of Canada's most prolific anti-racists. She's a woman in her 40s now, and her story, and I urge people to read her story. It's online. It's incredible. But she was the voice of the Heritage Front back in the 1990s. And she was one of the few women who were actually involved in the neo-Nazi movements. There was another woman as well by the name of Elise Hadigan who came in around the same time. And they used, in the real sense of the word, they used women in all kinds of ways. And one of them was to present a sweet face to a very hateful organization. And her story is fascinating. I mean, she went to a very mixed racial school in Toronto, where all kinds of different racialized communities were there. And being white was not necessarily privileged there, because you were probably in the minority. And she felt, and her story tells it better than I can, but she felt out of place and bullied and all kinds of things. And this was at the time of the rise of the Heritage Front. They approached her. She found something there that gave her, you know, emboldenment, and she ended up joining.
Well, that phrase you had there, that she felt out of place.
She felt out of place.
I think a lot of people feel out of place in some way.
Yeah.
And if that is left in out of community mm-hmm. and on the margins, and we don't find a place, we're more likely or more susceptible probably to something that's going to fill that gap.
And that filled the gap for her. And she went to Queen's University. She was a smart, articulate young woman. And I found myself at Queen's, it must have been mid-1990s, and I was doing a lecture on the whole issue of white supremacy. That seems to never go away. And she was already questioning the manner in which women were being treated within the hate movement. So she was already looking at why she was there and how she was being treated. And she approached me after my talk, and I knew she was there, and I talked about her. I didn't point her out, but I talked about the work that she had done in developing the hate movement. And she came up to me afterwards, and she said, "Are you here tomorrow?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, can we talk? And I said, "Yeah, sure, let's meet at a coffee shop." Anyway, we began a dialogue, a one-on-one dialogue that developed over the course of a year. It took a long time. And when she was in Toronto a few months later, I said to her, "I would like you to come to the Holocaust Education Center in Toronto. It's a very moving place." And she agreed. So I took her there. I arranged that nobody else was going to be there in that particular afternoon. And anybody who's been there, you'll notice that as you go in, it really tells the story of individuals who were caught up in the Holocaust. And there are these incredible pictures that are on the wall of families, you know, on picnics and at play. And then as you go on down, you see more pictures of camps and of children in the camps and mothers holding their children. And there's this one iconic picture of a mother holding her baby and two Nazi soldiers with guns, clearly ready, they're going to be shot in a moment. So I said to her, because she was a Holocaust denier as well, I said to her, "Okay, here's the proof that it happened, but here's the question I have for you, Elizabeth. This baby, what did this baby have to do with a worldwide Jewish conspiracy?" And she started to cry. And I started to cry. And I said, what are you feeling right now?" And she said, "I feel like I've lost all my humanity. I get it. I feel like I've lost all my humanity." And I said to her, "Well, you know, the interesting thing about humanity is that you can always get it back." Mm. And that was kind of a point for her where she kind of crossed the Rubicon. And today, she's married to a Jewish law professor, interestingly enough. They have a little girl who they're bringing up Jewish. She has spent much of the last 25 years working with schools, speaking about her experience, warning young people about the horrors of getting involved in hatred. And this is also about dialogue, isn't it? It's about a one-on-one dialogue. And her story